It's On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is not here today. Neither is Joy Cardine. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. And joining me on this special edition of On Your Money is Jane Bryant Quinn, personal finance expert and author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly in the AARP Bulletin. She's also working on a new book about making your retirement savings last, which is due out in January. Jane Bryant Quinn, welcome back to On Your Money.
Hi, John. Always nice to talk to you.
Well, and you're in a select group of people who say that. Summer is always a popular time for us to hit the pavement, and there's good news for those of us planning on making a road trip in the weeks ahead. AAA says gas prices may have topped out for the season and may even drop before too long. What's going on here?
Well, the forecast for summer and actually for the rest of the year is for gradually declining gasoline prices, always with the caveat that anything could change at any time. But the reason they're going down is that the world is awash in oil. Libya is exporting more. Saudi Arabia is keeping up its pumping. New refineries are coming online in the U.S., and the U.S. is pumping more gas, crude oil. So there is a lot around, and the economy is recovering, but it's not a huge boom globally. So I would say that unless we get some disaster, which is always possible out of the Middle East, that the outlook for drivers looks pretty good.
So the Federal Highway Administration said in May that Americans drove 720 billion miles in the first quarter of this year, the highest quarter on record. What does this say to you about the state of our economy?
Well, it says to me that the economy is continuing to recover. We can see unemployment going down, and we see also in some of the background numbers where more of the people who were working part-time unintentionally are now getting full-time jobs. And, you know, what makes our economy and in the global economy go, John, is jobs, rising jobs and rising incomes. And right now, on average, that is what we are seeing. And you can just see it reflected in the economy. You can look at all kinds of things, you know, taxes, this, that, all over the place. What makes economies go are more jobs and rising incomes. Incomes are up year over year, about 3%. That's not a lot, but it's up, and it's giving people more freedom to spend.
Well, when we know that when we expand the demand side of the economy and give people more ability to spend money on products, that helps. That's the piece that helps us grow the fastest.
That's the driver. That's the driver everywhere.
I remember that much from my sophomore economics class back in the age of stone knives and flint axes. One of the things that's happening here in Wisconsin that's going to affect motorists as we go on vacations this summer is that our highway crews have begun installing new speed limit signs across the state to reflect the 70-mile-per-hour speed limit that the legislature and the governor approved earlier this spring. So if you see a sign, you can legally go 70. Just a word to the wise on that, best not to go too far over that. On a broader note, you told producer Bill Martins that you're bullish about the U.S. economy based on employment. And is that a trend you see continuing, or is this just a kind of a blip on the radar?
It's a trend I see continuing. I just see good news everywhere. Now, one thing that you know slows things down a little on the edge is something, again, people don't think much about, and that's the strong dollar. The U.S. dollar is going up, and you know a lot of people think, oh, strong dollar, better for the United States. But the stronger the dollar gets, the more expensive our exports get, and you see that reflected sometimes in jobs or in profits. But that's, you know, so that is something that is out there on the horizon. But I don't see anything else. I am very bullish overall. Labor market conditions are improving, and you see it. A consumer optimism is improving. Spending is improving, as you pointed out. Driving is up because people can afford it. So I am pretty positive about this year. I know that, you know, the bull market and whatnot, they say, oh, it's been going on for so long. How much longer can it go? Well, you know, as long as we see improvement in jobs and in salaries and in pay in the economy is going to get better.
And not to get too far into the economic theory weeds here, but what accounts for the strong U.S. dollar right now?
Because of global weakness elsewhere, and so people are flocking into the U.S., you know, international people are flocking into the U.S. dollar as a safe place. It's one of the reasons that our Treasury interest rates are so low. You remember when it was Standard & Poor's decided, oh, dear, we had so much debt, and they were going to lower the credit rating of the U.S. dollar? And guess what happened? Even more people wanted to buy it, and interest rates went down even further because the U.S. dollar is considered the safest currency in the world. And we see the euro, you know, maybe Greece is going to exit the euro. There are all these issues running around. Certainly Japan, China, they don't have alternative currencies. So we have a very attractive currency, and people who want safety want to be in it.
Here's the number to call to join On Your Money today, a very special On Your Money. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Jane Bryant Quinn is also with me to answer your personal finance questions. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also join us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page and leave your question or comment there, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. Again, the number to call, 800-642-1234. You have a regular column in AARP magazine, and I just truth in advertising here, I'm actually a subscriber I'm old enough to subscribe to that magazine, and I do read it. But you wrote a column for AARP about how to get more out of your savings bonds. First, explain the difference between the two types of savings bonds, the double E bond and the I bond.
The I bond is one whose return is inflation adjusted, so you get a fixed rate plus an adjustment for the inflation over every 6 month period. And the double E bond has a fixed rate that goes on forever. So most of what's being sold are the I bonds. The E bonds have just not been attractive to people for a long time with their fixed rates, and they much prefer the I bonds with the inflation adjustment. Although, John, something interesting just happened, which is that earlier in the year, the I bonds were doing much better than CDs. So for people who wanted safety, you'd be better off in an I bond than in a CD. Well, every 6 months, the rate changes, and as of May 1st, all of a sudden, the I bonds are paying zero. Now, CDs are paying slightly more than zero, so after taxes, I don't know, they may be the same. But overall, the I bonds have proved to be a pretty good investment for people, for safety-minded people.
Okay, but you in your article, you lay out some mistakes that people make with their savings bonds that end up costing them money. The first error is to cash in the oldest bonds first. What's wrong with that? That seems that seems like intuitively that's what I should be doing.
Well, certainly if the bond is 30 years old or more, you should cash it in, because first, it's not earning any more interest after 30 years, and also you owe taxes whether you cash it in or not, so you might as well cash it in and get the money. But because the interest rate on savings bonds is tax deferred. But there's another whole set of savings bonds, and these are people who've had them for years and years and years, and they may be 20, they may be 25 years old. And when you look at them, you say, oh, well, these are the oldest, and they probably have the most interest on them. I'm going to cash them in. But then when you look at what they are actually returning, they may be paying a higher rate of interest than many of your newer bonds. So you need to find out before you say, okay, these are the bonds I'm going to turn in. You need to find out what they are actually paying now and hang on to the bonds which are apt to be older bonds that are paying the highest rate of interest.
And you also
You can find that at treasury.gov, which has a whole section on savings bonds, and they'll tell you what each bond is currently returning right now.
You also warn about the dangers of cashing in too many bonds at once, and your article also provides some advice on when is the best time to redeem bonds. Why shouldn't I cash in too many bonds at once?
Well, the question is, how much money do you need? If you say, oh, gosh, I need $5,000 right now, this is going to be what I need for the year, this will be helpful to me, and so you go with bonds with face amounts for $5,000 and you cash them in. But it turns out maybe you're actually getting $10,000 because the interest on that $5,000 face bond may have accumulated, so these bonds are now worth $10,000. Now, that's fine. You get an extra $5,000. But what if it puts you into a higher tax bracket? That's not going to be a good thing. So you need to know with your savings bonds what rate they're returning and also how much interest has been added to the bond so you know what you're actually going to get if you turn the bond in. And as far as timing, 6 months, interest is paid once every 6 months, and it would be a shame to cash in a bond one day before the interest was paid.
Well, right, yeah, you would do yourself out of some money. Let's take some calls. We have some people who want to join the program, and room for you, 800-642-1234. We'll go to Green Bay first, where Colin is with us. Colin, welcome to On Your Money.
Hey, guys, thank you. I just had a quick question. I work for a small business. I've opened a Roth IRA. My wife has a 401k, but the business is not. The owner isn't comfortable opening up one for all of his employees, basically. So I was just curious if there's another way for me to invest beyond the IRA, which I max out on a yearly basis.
And you're talking about investing for your retirement savings.
Exactly. Thank you.
Well, first, congratulations for being in a Roth IRA, because that's the type of IRA that, first, you're never forced to cash it in at 70 and a half, and when you do take the money out, there is no income tax due on the interest. Mm-hmm. So you've made absolutely the right choice for an IRA. After that, for tax-deferred vehicles, there are, of course, annuities, but I'm not a big fan of those, as John knows, because we've talked about those before at other times. And so my preference would be first, I think it's great that you have extra money. My preference would be for you starting to invest in index funds, low-cost index funds, Vanguard or Fidelity, funds that follow the stock market, follow the bond market, probably the same way you're investing your Roth IRA. It is an investment which is taxable every year from the interest due. But you know, when you invest in these great big index funds like a total market fund or a fund that follows the Standard & Poor's 500, there are not a lot of taxes due every year because there's not that kind of turnover and they are managed for tax efficiency. So I would take a look at that, because you'd also be then building up a nice nest egg outside a tax-deferred investment, which is good because that money is always available to you.
Colin, good luck, and thanks for your call this morning. This is a very special edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley's off this week. Joy Cardine is on an Alaskan cruise. Jane Bryant Quinn is with us, though. When we come back, we're going to talk about the advantages, particularly for seniors, of prepaying your mortgage. And later in the program, how to be on guard for misleading investment advisors. And then, of course, more of your personal finance calls for Jane Bryant Quinn. 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A house in the middle of
It's a very special edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley off this week, and Joy Cardine is on an Alaskan cruise. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Jane Bryant Quinn is with me this morning. Jane Bryant Quinn, of course, a personal finance expert and author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly in the AARP Bulletin. Let's take a call from Kate in Johnson Creek. Kate, hello. Welcome to On Your Money.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I always enjoy your show. And my question is, my husband passed away this spring, and I have his IRA to deal with. It has been suggested to me that I convert his IRA to a Roth IRA and pay the taxes on it now this year, because my income without his will be so low, and it will be better to pay the taxes on that money now than later on to have my heirs pay those taxes with their greater incomes. It seems like a good idea to me. I'm just looking for a second opinion.
Of course, I haven't looked exactly at the numbers that you have. So my one question is, if you pay the taxes now, are you paying it out of the proceeds of the IRA, or do you have enough money to pay the taxes from other funds?
I have enough money to pay the taxes from other funds.
Okay, I would say that that's critical, because you want to keep that IRA intact as much as possible. So that sounds like if, as long as you pay the taxes with other funds and you're in a low bracket, that sounds like a very plausible thing to do for you, and I think it's a nice thing to do for your heirs.
Okay, thank you very much.
Kate, thank you for joining us this morning and On Your Money. Jane Bryant Quinn, one of the other articles you recently wrote for the AARP magazine has to do with the financial crunch that some seniors have. You wrote about, it's not consumer debt that's necessarily squeezing the budget of families entering retirement, but mortgage debt. Can you give us a sense of how tight this can make our finances as we head toward our golden years?
Well, of course, the idea used to be that you would have your mortgage paid up by the time you retire, and a lot of retirees are still in that fortunate position. But increasingly, people are entering retirement with quite large mortgage debt. And then all you have to, then you just have to figure out how to pay it off, whether you can refinance it at a lower rate. But I'm in favor of, for anybody who is in a position to, you know, do it at this point, if you're still working, is to try to prepay your mortgage. But I've got a couple of questions here. First, any spare money that you have, if you've got consumer debt, you should get rid of that first, because that's your high interest debt. If you're not funding your IRA or other retirement programs, we just heard from Colin, who's funding his Roth IRA to the max. That's terrific. Any spare money that you have after consumer debt, put into your retirement plan. If you still have spare money after that, then prepaying a mortgage becomes a very interesting option. If you would otherwise just spend that money, by all means, use it to prepay. If you would otherwise put that money in a bank CD, also use that money to prepay. If you are in a long-term investor and you would put that spare money into, say, stock-owning mutual funds for the long term, that might be a better option than prepaying, but of course that's riskier. That's something that you have to consider yourself. But any move toward entering retirement with a prepaid mortgage or a very low mortgage is very positive, because once your paycheck stops, then things can squeeze you pretty fast.
Well, what about the idea that some people still have about, well, you know, my mortgage, that interest is tax deductible and I could use that tax deduction? That certainly was true when mortgage rates were 12% and higher. But with interest rates at 4% and less, is that still true?
Well, first, your standard deduction may be larger than the tax deduction on your mortgage if your mortgage has is now a small one. But John, you just set my head on fire when you said I need a tax deduction. That is one of the biggest scams that's been passed on to American homeowners in the world. Nobody needs a tax deduction. I mean, if you're in the 25% bracket and you pay $100 in interest, okay, you get your tax deduction is now $25. But the other $75 you have paid out of pocket. Nobody needs a tax deduction. And if you have no debt, I would say that you are in a very good position. Nobody needs a tax deduction. It's just, I mean, you just kind of said it. People say that all the time. I need a tax deduction. I better have a mortgage interest. No.
Well,
did I sound excited?
You did, and I really didn't mean to set your hair on fire. That sounds kind of scary, but now I'm going to have
I'm tamping it down even as we speak.
Okay, well, that's good. I don't want to throw cold water on the conversation, but I think I could be in a little bit of trouble at home because I said the reason I needed a studio in our basement was so we could write off part of the house. Any special advice?
That's different.
Okay. Oh, good. Thank you. So I can quote you on that? Good. Jane Bryan Quinn says I can have my studio. That's good.
But that's a business deduction. Different from saying I better keep a mortgage because I, quote, need a tax deduction.
Got it. Well, her counter to that is, but your business doesn't bring in any money so far. Stay out of this, and I should move on. Do you have any special advice for those of us who can't afford to prepay our mortgage? What should we do?
Well, then I would say you need to be saving money. You need to be preparing for retirement in the normal way. And when you're looking at retirement, you just have to have a budget that will, in fact, be able to cover your mortgage payments and everything else. Sometimes it's downsizing. Sometimes there are other cuts that can be made. Sometimes it's working part-time in a basement studio. and you are able to do it, but it just has to be built into your budget. Now, one strategy which is kind of interesting for people who, for one reason or another, have a large mortgage on the eve of retirement and maybe 15 more years to pay or something like that, if you refinance that into a 30-year mortgage, one could say my long-term 30-year interest would be higher, but if your monthly payments are lower and if you are really being squeezed on your retirement budget, that's at least something to look at.
Okay. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. It's a very special edition of On Your Money. Jane Bryan Quinn, a personal finance expert and author of Making the Most of Your Money Now, has joined me on the program today. By the way, Jane Bryan Quinn is also working on a new book about making your retirement savings last, which is due out next January, and her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly in the AARP Bulletin. We have an email from Rose, who writes, "My husband and I live in the family home. We are planning on receiving it when my mother-in-law passes away, but are worried about problems that can occur with the long-term care she may need and other fine print issues that could jeopardize inheriting the home. We cannot afford to purchase the home in a traditional way, but also would never sell. My mother-in-law lives in a second residence and does not wish to return to the home. She would like it if we took it over before she passes. Do you recommend adding our names to the title? The mortgage is paid off."
If you are the people who are... this is an estate planning issue and could be a tax issue. So I want to say right off the bat here that I can't make, obviously, any tax idea, proposals, or suggestions because I'm not a tax person and I don't know your personal situation. If indeed you are going to be the inheritors of the house, I don't see any reason why your mother couldn't give it to you now if that was what she wanted to do. If she needs long-term care and will apply for Medicaid, then the value and I think it's now it's a 5 or a 7 year look back. The Medicaid people will look back and say, oh, well, did she give an asset away? And if she did during that look back period, then she won't qualify for Medicaid for a while if she goes into a nursing home. And that's a very important thing to consider. And the other thing, I guess the other thing to consider is just the tax position. And that's something I'm not I can't really deal with.
Yeah, you might want to.
But you don't have any other siblings that. I hope they're in. Also, I gather that just the two of you are going to inherit the house. If there are other siblings who expect some sort of inheritance, that could certainly be a complication for you and for your mother.
Yeah, and probably wouldn't hurt to consult an attorney who is familiar with those specific issues.
Absolutely, 100%. When you're talking about transferring houses and long-term care costs and those kinds of things, this is Attorneyville for sure.
You bet. Okay, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join On Your Money today on the Ideas Network. Let's turn, Jane Brian Quinn, to what you call slippery salespeople. How cautious do people need to be about investment advisors who may be out to snow us?
You know, it's astonishing to me how often the tried and true old pitches work and work and work. And they seem to work especially on older people. And the slippery salespeople come after older people because that's where the money is. Young people don't have as much money to spend on various types of investments that are pumped to older people. And also, although I hate to say it, as we pass... I think most of the research shows that in one way or another, in one corner of our brain or another, we're pretty sharp until 70 or early 70s. But then after that, you start facing various kinds of risks of whether you can actually evaluate what you're being told. I just hate thinking about that, but that does happen. So it behooves you to really set up a very careful investment plan and before you start reaching older ages, and then just stick to that plan and don't be derailed by somebody coming along with some crazy pitch like, you can earn 30% a year or 50% a year or this is an investment that always beats the market or high fixed returns guaranteed. I mean, all of this stuff, it works over and over and over again, and I hope it will not work for anybody listening.
Well, a wise man once told me that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are carnies and there are marks. And he always said, always be a carny, never be a mark.
I'm very sorry to hear you're taking up being a carny.
Well, I'm in radio. I think I've always been a carny. I've been in radio most of my life. But, you would think that people who have some investment experience would be better equipped to spot some of these things. Like they would know better that, there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine or some investment that's guaranteed to produce a 30% or better return. It kind of defies logic that people with experience in investing get fooled, but they do. I know that happened to somebody else, but boy, this is a sure thing. Where does that come from?
One thing, by the way, is that people who have investing experience are more apt to be scammed than people who don't, because people who don't are much more apt to say, oh, I don't understand that, I don't think I'll do it, whereas people with investing experience are more apt to think they're really clever and that maybe they can make this work. And also, men are more apt to fall for those kinds of pitches than women, which is also interesting. A lot of the misleading sales comes from what they call affinity carnies, We belong to the same church, the same temple, the same bowling team or country club or whatever it is. And because you know each other in a social setting, somehow you think, oh, well, he's not going to cheat me. He goes to my church. And then if he does cheat you, he asks forgiveness, and your church says you should forgive him, right? Kind of. They'll say, I put my own mother in it, and she lost. I feel terrible. Excuse me, that's, as you correctly call it, a carny.
Yeah.
And something else, here's something that I found. A woman did a fascinating study at Georgetown University, PhD, where on full disclosure, you say, you're supposed to say, okay, how much money are you going to make on it? What is your commission? It turns out that if when salespeople say, I'm going to make money on this, yes, but you'll make money too, people are more apt to buy it, even if they suspect it's bad. And there's something that says that the salesperson is kind of subtly asking you to help him or her by making this investment, and so that person can earn a commission. It's the craziest thing. I couldn't believe it when I first read the study, but I talked to her at some length, and it turns out that disclosing commissions makes you more willing to buy a bad investment than keeping commissions hidden.
I'm raising money to go to band camp. Buy my candy. All right, let's.
You are full of entrepreneurial issues today.
Oh yeah, I got a million of them. I never saw a cheap joke I didn't like. Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, something maybe a little more serious, end of life decisions, and then more personal finance questions with Jane Bryan Quinn on this special On Your Money edition. On the Ideas Network, John Munson in for Joy Cardine. We'll be right back. It's a very special edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Jane Bryant Quinn is joining me in this hour. She is a personal finance expert, author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly in the AARP Bulletin. And she's also working on a new book about making your retirement savings last, which is due out in January. And tell us, Jane, a little bit about that book.
Well, it's called How to Make Your Money Last, and it is for people who are in their, say, 50s, planning on retirement, or people who have retired early, maybe voluntarily, maybe not voluntarily, people in their 60s who have recently retired. And when your paycheck stops, you have a certain amount of money, and you don't know how long you're going to live, and you have to figure out how to parcel that amount of money over an unknown lifespan. It is a very tricky and difficult time when you're trying to set up a retirement budget under that situation. And so that is what I'm writing about, to help you make these decisions with budgeting. I talk about annuities, or when to claim Social Security, what kind of investments to make, health insurance. I am watching as closely as anybody else what the Supreme Court is going to do about the subsidies to the ACA, the Obamacare, because that's been a huge help for people age, say, 50 to 65 before they go on Medicare. If they have pre-existing conditions, this law has been a huge help to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's one reason I haven't. I was going to publish the book in September, John, but I have to wait for this decision, because whatever happens to that ACA law is going to very strongly affect people under 65 as far as health insurance is concerned. So these are all of the issues that you have to confront when you're thinking about retiring and how you are going to live on the savings you've accumulated. It's a very interesting topic, I have to say.
My retirement plan involves a winning lottery ticket, so I'll let you know how that works out. Let's take a call from Jeff in Madison. Jeff, welcome to On Your Money.
Yes, thank you. My question is this. I'm 59 years old, wanting to retire early, and I have one house in northern Wisconsin that I was thinking on doing a reverse mortgage. That's my main house. Also have a place in Florida, but wanting to know reverse mortgages, using that as some income, is that a smart way to go?
The reverse mortgage is something that first you qualify as early as 62. You can borrow a certain amount of money against the equity value of your house, and then it is paid out to you as long as you live in the house. If you leave the house because you die or you enter a nursing home or you go live in Florida instead of in northern Michigan, then you then the mortgage will come due. Normally, reverse mortgages are used later in life, 70 plus, if people are running short of money and they want to stay in their homes for a while longer and they get a reverse mortgage, which gives them income not taxed. It's just a loan paid out to you that's payable when you leave the house. One possibility for cash flow, which I think is what Jeff is bringing up here, is that you take it early at 62 and take it not in the form of a lump sum, because a lump sum is very expensive and new rules have just made it even more expensive. But if you took it in the form of a credit line, and then that credit line is available to you, which you can draw on every month or every 6 months or whenever you want to draw it. And what's interesting about this credit line is that the amount of the credit line increases every year by the percentage you are paying on the mortgage. So this is not a bad kind of inflation hedge, because your credit line will actually, the total available credit line will actually grow over time, which is kind of weird, but that's how the reverse mortgage works. But it will work for you as something to help with your cash flow only if you don't take the lump sum, take it as a credit line, and be very careful about how much you take out of that credit line every year.
Jeff, thanks. Thanks for your call. 800-642-1234, the number to call for On Your Money today. 800-642-1234, email talk@WPR.org. Or you can post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Nobody likes to think about their final days on Earth, but it is something we all need to confront in the event that someone has to make medical decisions for us. Let's talk about these end-of-life decisions and good medical planning. How do we get started with that?
Well, the first thing is to do it. You know, a surprising number of people don't want to think about it, don't do anything about it, and then there is some kind of a medical crisis, and you haven't left any instructions, and you're not sure who is in charge, and your three children start arguing about, you know, what kind of treatment you should get, and then you are in their hands. You have completely given up your sovereignty over yourself because you didn't make those decisions for yourself. And so I guess the biggest thing I want to say about this is simply do it. Make some decisions and don't let those important decisions fall out of your hands. One thing to do, just to, talking about your kids, is to make sure that all your financial records are in order and your kids know where they are and no insurance policies that they're never going to collect because you kept them hidden somewhere and they got thrown out when they cleaned out the house. So that's important. It is very, very important to have some kind of medical proxy, somebody who you have appointed on an official piece of paper, signed and notarized according to your state law, saying who can speak for you medically if you are unable to speak for yourself. And your doctor should have it. It should, your the your medical proxy should have a copy. It should be with your financial records. This is not to say that doctors will always follow it, but doctors are supposed to, and at least you have made some kind of decision to say, if you can't make decisions for yourself at the end of life, what would you like in general, but who is authorized to speak for you?
So how can we get our wishes into a legally binding document?
Well, first, I hope everybody has a will. That's one good thing. And then the same attorney who draws up a will, it will draw up a power of attorney, and the power of attorney is somebody who can handle your financial affairs, and you can limit or list the kinds of financial affairs that you want the attorney to be able to handle if you are unable to do it yourself, and a durable power of attorney, that is. And at the same time, you'll get the health care proxy and what they call a living will, where you state what your general desires are for end-of-life treatment, and then you name a proxy. Now, there are some places online where you can get these documents, documents that are state-specific, which are very important. And I never recommend them for wills, to tell you the truth, but you could probably get a healthcare proxy online from places like NOLO.com, N-O-L-O.com, and there are others. But you've got to be very, very careful to follow the instructions precisely for your state, get them witnessed, get them notarized, whatever Wisconsin or any other state that you live in requires. Another thing is talking to your kids about it, because if you have more than one child and you name one child your power of attorney or give one child your healthcare proxy, maybe the other child gets his or her nose out of joint. I'm a great believer in sitting down with your family and saying why you made these decisions, or talking about these decisions even before you make them, so that if these proxies have to be exercised, it's not a shock or a surprise, and all the kids are on the same page, saying yes, we agree that that John has the right to talk here, although he's going to talk to all the other siblings as well.
Well, that's one case where being an only child is actually an advantage. I don't have any siblings to fight with. But
I have five. So
well, good luck. Let's take a call here from Ray in Stevens Point. Ray, thanks for joining On Your Money today.
Regarding reverse mortgages, I understood that when you leave the house or you die, the home is then owned by the lender. If you are hoping to leave it to your family, your kids, that's not possible. It actually goes to the lender. And if your family wanted to keep the home, they would actually have to buy it on the open market from the lender. Is that correct?
The home doesn't necessarily go to the lender in this sense. What happens when you leave the home is that you have to pay off the loan. And normally the loan is paid off by selling the house. Now, if the loan is larger than the value of the house, then yes, the house goes to the lender. If the loan is smaller than the value of the house, the extra amount goes to the heirs. And yes, if the heirs want to own the house, they are going to have to buy it from the lender, and there are rules regarding how much they have to pay for. They don't have to pay more. I think it's market value plus 5%, but don't hold me to that because I'm not looking at the rule right now. But at any rate, yes, if they want to have the house, they will have to buy it. So one thing about doing a reverse mortgage is that you understand that this is part of, this is part of your own estate. You bought the house, you paid for it, like your savings, your home equity belongs to you, and if you want to use it to make your life better in retirement, it's your money and you're entitled to it, and so the kids won't get the home. If you would rather have, if you don't need that money or you'd rather have the kids get the home, then don't take the reverse mortgage. But my feeling always is that this money is yours. And, whereas Jeff's looking to retire, our earlier caller looking to retire early, and he's trying to put together cash flow, it's his house. You don't have to say, I must leave this house to my kids. But it's part of the reverse mortgage decision, no question.
Ray, thanks. Thanks for your call. This is a special edition of On Your Money on Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Jane Bryant-Quinn is with me today. We talked a little bit earlier about talking to our kids about our end of life decisions and making sure that everybody knows what the plan is, so no one gets their nose out of joint by being surprised. On a related note, what about talking to adult children about our money? A lot of financial planners say we need to have these conversations about our will, our financial records, life insurance policies, and you said it's important that the kids know where those are so that they can collect if there's anything left on them. Let's talk about having that conversation.
This is a conversation, again, this is a very interesting question because some parents would not dream of talking with their kids about money. It's their own. It's private. They don't want anything known until after they die. And others, and I'm among the others, believes in a much fuller disclosure. I don't tell my kids exactly what I'm worth because I may use up all that money myself in long-term care or some other thing. But I do tell them how the money is going to be divided in the will. And it's roughly even with a few exceptions. But the exceptions are, again, always very important. If you're going to leave more money to one child for some reason than you leave to another, it shouldn't be a surprise in your will. It's something that you should talk to your kids about and say, I'm making this decision for this reason, and I hope you'll all understand. And if you have got a good reason and you've got a good functioning family, they will understand. I just think that if everything's going to be divided evenly and all you say to your kids is, here's the financial records, each of you, here's two of you, you each get half, goodbye, that's kind of simple. But if you have something more complicated in the way you're leaving property, you really should talk about it in advance. They should hear it from you. And one other part, if you are apt to run out of money and the kids are apt to have to kick in, the sooner they know that, the better. And that's a really hard one to face because you don't want to admit that you might have to run out of money. But if you bring your kids into your financial situation so they can help you with the planning and they can help with their own planning if something has to be done to help you, this is a kindness you are doing for your children.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Jane Bryant-Quinn, and I had one more question, but I realize we won't have enough time to get the answer, so there's no point in asking it. But appreciate you being here. Well, I try to be, and I have learned how to read a clock in 40 years in broadcasting, so my father despaired that would ever happen, but I finally did figure it out. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'll be looking forward to seeing your book come out in January, and hopefully we get to talk together again before then.
It's always my pleasure to talk to you and to your audience.
Okay. Jane Bryant-Quinn is a personal finance expert and author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. Her column, Financially Speaking, appears monthly in the AARP Bulletin. And again, she's working on a new book about making your retirement savings last, which we hope will be out in January. Next week, Joy and Kevin. Well, actually, Joy won't be back next week, but Kevin will be back. I think Joy's back in 2 weeks. I don't know. I think it's next week. Nope, Joy will be back next week. And Kevin will be along with her, and they'll have a very special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. But that's this week's On Your Money. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. I'm certain about that because, I'm sitting here today. Joy and Kevin will be back next week for more of On Your Money, and you can have your questions answered next week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.